Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. I'm Jordan Edwards, Communications Associate at the BJC. Today we will be hearing the keynote address delivered by Marvin A. McMickle at the 2015 Religious Liberty Council luncheon. But before we get to that address, I have BJC Director of Operations and Development, Taryn Deaton, with me to talk a little bit more about the luncheon. So Taryn, tell me why this year's luncheon is so special.
Well, Jordan, this year's luncheon is special because we will be celebrating Brent Walker's 27 years of service with the Baptist Joint Committee, and it will really be the opportunity for the Religious Liberty Council to celebrate Brent and to kind of look forward to his retirement and wishing him well as he closes out his time with the BJC.
Okay, and for someone who hasn't been to a Religious Liberty Council luncheon before, what can they expect?
Well, it's a great time of fellowship with people who support the BJC. The Religious Liberty Council itself is actually made up of supporters of the Baptist Joint Committee, people who financially support the Baptist Joint Committee. So the luncheon is really kind of put on by the Religious Liberty Council to be a time to come together in fellowship and also a time to learn more about religious freedom. And so every year we have a different speaker. This podcast is focused on Dr. McMickle speech from last year, but Brent will be our speaker this year. And we also have, there's some business that we do. We have the Religious Liberty Council has representatives on our board. And so during the time we also do, I have to do some elections of people who will be serving on our board in the future. But it's just it's a fun time of fellowship and seeing old friends and just a nice time to come around and, you know, celebrate religious freedom and kind of get updated on what the BJC is doing.
Okay, thanks, Taryn. And you can buy tickets on our website at bjconline.org/luncheon. And this year's luncheon is in Greensboro, North Carolina. It's held each year in conjunction with the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship General Assembly. Okay, so without further ado, let's hear last year's RLC luncheon keynote address delivered by Marvin A. McMickle, who is the president of Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School.
I want to thank Brent Walker for the invitation. Very kind, very generous. Thank all of you for being here. Thank the Baptist Joint Committee and the Religious Liberty Council for the work that all of you do and for taking the time to be a part of the events on today. We are under some particular time constraints, and so I'm going to do what most Baptist preachers do, which is take off my watch and then proceed to ignore it. But at least I have made the good faith effort to act as if I'm paying attention to the time. By the workings of Providence, we are gathered on the 150th anniversary of Juneteenth. I am not sure if you are familiar with the term Juneteenth, but it points to the date of June the 19th, 1865, when news about the abolition of slavery, which was declared on January the 1st, 1863, finally arrived in the state of Texas. For 2.5 years, Texas refused to acknowledge that slavery had been abolished, and for 2 months after the Civil War, Texas continued in the trafficking in human life. I begin with a reference to Juneteenth because there is an important connection between religious liberty and human freedom that has brought me before you today. I have the greatest admiration for the work that is done by this organization. And I come to thank you for the work that you do to remind us of maintaining the appropriate separation between the powers of the government and the polity and practices of the church. I agree with and give thanks to Stephen Prothero in his book, Religious Literacy, who states, thanks to the Establishment Clause, American government is secular by law. Thanks to the Free Exercise Clause, American society is religious by choice. I agree with you that the power of the state should never be used to prefer one religious tradition above any and all others. And I'm only too aware historically of the centuries-long struggle of religious intolerance and the quest for religious liberty. How much blood was shed in Europe, and over how many years, in feuds between Roman Catholics and Protestants? How many Jewish people were hounded and hunted and humiliated, all because of their religious distinctions from the Christian majorities throughout the countries of Europe? The clear link between the power of the state and the practices of the church was never more clearly displayed than with the Act of Uniformity in England in 1558. The Act of Uniformity that mandated weekly attendance at the Church of England and limited voting rights only to those who are members in good standing of some parish within the Anglican Church. The Act of Uniformity, 1558, was followed by the Act of Toleration, 1689, which allowed other Protestant groups, they called them dissenters, to worship in their own way, but only so long as those persons swore an oath of allegiance to the English monarch. It should be noted, however, that even the Act of Toleration specifically stated that Roman Catholics and Unitarians were not to be given religious liberty. What occurred between these two acts? What occurred between the Act of Uniformity and the Act of Toleration? Well, it was the 30 Years' War, 1618 to 1648, which was essentially a war between European monarchs, nations, and their state-sanctioned religions. Historian John Barry states it this way: the 30 Years' War was when Christians killed other Christians over how they worshiped Christ. How tragic that the notion of a state supported, sometimes state-mandated church was then introduced into this country by its European settlers, first in Jamestown and later in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Allow me to read to you something written by Michael Myerson in his book, Endowed by Our Creator, in describing the fate of Baptists who sought religious liberty in Virginia in 1651. Each person caught observing the Baptist faith received 30 strokes with a three-cord whip until his blood flowed in little streams down to the waist, soaking into the clothing. John Ragosta adds to that by saying, by the time of the American Revolution, more than half of the Baptist ministers in Virginia had suffered jail time. Scores of Baptists and Presbyterians had been jailed, beaten, dunked, fined, and otherwise harassed. All of this was just a part of what led the framers of the Constitution to shape the First Amendment. Those words we've already heard today: Congress shall pass no law regarding the establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof. I honor the struggle for religious liberty. But this is Juneteenth. And so I turn to what is perhaps the most ironic, maybe hypocritical dimension of the long quest for religious liberty in Europe and the United States. During the entire time that Holland and Spain and England and British colonies in North America were seeking religious liberty for themselves, during the entire time, all of the above nations were actively involved in the transatlantic slave trade that denied physical liberty to tens of millions of people. While John Calvin, Ulrich Zwingli, Martin Luther, Roger Williams, Henry VIII, and Elizabeth I were laying the foundations for their soul liberty, Europe and the Americas were simultaneously involved in what David Brian Davis of the New York Times described as one of history's greatest crimes against humanity. It would seem, therefore, that soul liberty mattered much less when confronted with the prospect of prosperity on the backs of human slavery. The position that I and most African American clergy hold with regard to the issues of the separation of church and state cannot be understood unless you first understand this. What happened between the 15th and 19th centuries, when both the church and the state worked together to build their economies on the backs of slave labor? The New York Times recently had an article that was in response to the discovery of a slave ship that was brought to surface. And in the context of that, it made the following observation. The slave trade was not fueled by hatred. It was fueled by greed. The colonizers wanted cheap labor to produce sugar and tobacco and coffee and indigo and other goods demanded by the aristocracies of Europe and the Americas. In short, while the enlightened nations of the West were debating their freedom to worship God according to their conscience, those same nations, at the same time, were denying actual physical liberty to the 12.5 million Africans who made it to this country, and the 2.5 million who died in the process of the transport. W.E.B. Du Bois observed in his book, The Suppression of the African Slave Trade, the following observation, lest you think that slavery somehow was limited to Texas or Arkansas or some southern location. He said, southern states established restrictions on the slave trade as a safeguard against slave insurrections. We discovered just recently that the South Carolina school, the Citadel, was constructed after the attempted slave uprising in South Carolina in 1822, which was plotted in the Emmanuel AME Church, which was attacked just this week The Citadel Military Academy was constructed within sight of Emmanuel AME Church to guarantee that no slave uprising would be successful. But, says Du Bois, the other colonies in the North also had slave restrictions, meaning restrictions on the practice of slavery in their state, only because they could not find a crop that would make it profitable. However, just because they didn't have a crop didn't mean they didn't have a hand in it. Du Bois picks on the state of Rhode Island and says that between 1698 and 1708, 103 slave vessels were built and sailed from Rhode Island to maintain the northern part of the country's involvement in the trafficking in human flesh. Why do I share all this with you today? I share this with you today in order to help you understand the composition of this room and why perhaps more African Americans are not in, and why they view the issue of separation of church and state with a jaundiced view. It is because of the historic collaboration between the white church and white governments in the perpetuation of the suffering and exploitation. The state by its actions, and sadly, the church by its silence. And today, while you continue to discuss religious liberty and the separation of church and state, and you should, I remind you of the letter from the Birmingham jail, written by Martin Luther King Jr. to protest the segregation statutes in Alabama. But he didn't write the letter because of that. He wrote the letter because he had received a letter from 8 members of the clergy in Birmingham telling him that his actions were wrong and should not be engaged in. Can't you wait a little longer? Wait for the freedoms that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments had already guaranteed. Many black clergy got involved in politics, not just as voters, I mind you, but even as those who pursued public office, because they saw that the only way they could alter the course of history so far as their struggle was concerned was to put their hands on the levers of political power. But they did not do it because they wanted to use the work of the government in order to influence issues of sectarian interest. They were not trying to make sure they were good Baptists and everybody was being baptized or everybody was taking communion in a certain way. They did not do it because of those reasons. They did it for the reason that was given by Robert McAfee Brown, who said they wanted to use politics as a means of grace. Or in the language of Anthony Penn, they wanted to let their religious sensibilities inform them in a way that could shape government policies for the welfare of the underprivileged. Black ministers in politics, like Clementa Pinckney, pastor of the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, and a 4-term member of the South Carolina State Senate, who had just introduced a bill in the South Carolina legislature to safeguard the church against the presence of guns in the house of the Lord, declaring the church to be a gun-free zone. And while the bill was pending, someone came into his church, and among the 9 that were shot and killed was Clementa Pinckney, pastor, state senator. What will you say about reduction in voting rights for African Americans? What do you say about limiting the program called Soul to the Polls, voting on Sundays? What will you say about no same-day registration? What will you say about voter ID laws designed to prevent voter fraud, which does not exist? What will you say? I believe in the First Amendment, and I believe in the work that you do. And I've come to encourage you in that work and to pray God's blessings upon it. But I believe in something else, not something more, just something else. I believe that American history and its economic foundation was largely written in the blood of African slaves and their descendants. Amen. A story that many in this country do not want to hear. I would say more about the role of the suppression of Native Americans and the appropriation of their land as part of the story about how the West was won. But that's for somebody else on another day. As for today, I say to you with all my heart that this nation has not yet resolved all of the lingering effects of Juneteenth. Slavery, segregation, second-class status, and the presumptions of white supremacy operating in the mind of a shooter in South Carolina who said, "You are taking our country from us." Really? All one-tenth of us? When I was a college student, there was a song by Simon and Garfunkel called "The Sound of Silence." While you are speaking on the separation of church and state and your interests in the matter of religious liberty, I invite you, I implore you, I encourage you to not continue the sound of silence on the issues of injustice and inequality that go on in this country almost undisturbed. Today is Juneteenth. 150 years ago, slavery was finally ended in this country, not by any moral persuasion, but by the Union Army. But the pain goes on, as does the struggle. Religious liberty is good, but so is physical freedom. Keep the faith by breaking the silence.
That was Marvin A. McMickle delivering the keynote address at the 2015 Religious Liberty Council luncheon. For more on the luncheon, you can go to our website at bjconline.org/luncheon. And thank you for listening to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. For more podcasts, go to our podcast page at bjconline.org/podcasts or subscribe to our iTunes channel.